done that. For those of you who haven't been here before, I guess the way to say it, Bob has a particular role in this history. As far as I know, he's sort of like the first white Christian in SNCCRET. He's the first white field secretary that I know of. We'll correct that later. I do know he's the last.
First time, the last time.
The issue of the expulsion of whites comes to the fore. By that time, he has spent his adult life, such as it was then, 6 years of his life, full-time commitment to the movement with an enviable reputation for both courage and honor. Mm-hmm. Right? A person who is not about himself. Right? Black Power comes along, and he didn't remember this. Right? He has a particular role in this history, so whatever you like about it.
Thank you. Charles had asked me specifically before to talk about my reaction to the volunteers. And volunteers were actually in two levels. One was in 63, when the first volunteers came down, I think with Al Lawrence and so forth, and the second was in 64. And I was in a fairly unique position vis-a-vis the volunteers because I was a white Southerner. I was already a experienced veteran at the time. And so my reaction, I guess, to the volunteers would be fairly important. Because the discussion in 63 about having the summer of 64 was informed by the experience of the late discussion in 63 was informed by two things. One was the murder of Lewis Allen. Lewis Allen was a witness to the murder of Herbert Lee in October or September of 1961. And as late as the, I think, December of 63, he was murdered because he had decided that he had to leave the state. It was basically he had to leave the state of Mississippi because the Klan was going to kill him because he had been a witness to the murder, had told the Justice Department. The Justice Department had told the local police, which is the same as telling the Klan. And he had now decided he had to leave the state. And on really, literally, probably the last night that he would spend in Mississippi, he came home that night, he got out of his truck to open the gate to his farm, and he was shot and killed by a shotgun by assailants. Now that was another case then that we took on as our heart. It hurts us in our heart that people who have been involved with our struggle are getting killed. And it was Moses, Bob Moses, the great mythological Bob Moses, who put his prestige on the line then in the winter of 63 and early part of 64 to say, no matter what reticence we may have about bringing in volunteers, because some local people had already experienced the arrogance of the Northern students. I had already experienced a certain amount of embarrassment because, you know, they're white, right? And the arrogance and the just don't get it-ness was incredible. And you just had to wonder how people could go through the education that they had gone through and not have basic sensitivity of manners, for instance, you know? And I didn't take upon myself the particular job, I think, of educating them in terms of the sensitivity. That was left to Gwen and who were working it out in the local levels and saying, hey, look, you're not going to go around here like, a sex queen and everything, because I never had any basic any difficulties on the sex issue myself. Because I had a clear understanding of the relationship between white Southern men and black women. So I never had any notions whatsoever. And if I did, I put them out right away. I was that disciplined that day. I was young. We were all young. And we all participated in a lot of sex.
Just 1 minute. I have a tell the story where my whole project Project almost got run out of Laurel because of a house where we were living. The people went out of town, and the folks kept, you know, the staff kept saying, "We need a party." And I kept saying, "But we can't party." We're like, "Yeah, we got the party." And of course, I was like, "Are you not going to get drunk? Are you not going to get loud, et cetera?" And everybody got drunk, loud, out on the lawn with no clothes on, et cetera. We were called up in the church, had to line up and admit our sins. So I, hey.
So like I said, we were young and we threw our sex, but you could be discreet about it.
Yes, we were discreet that day.
And some of us were disciplined and some were not. I attempted to be disciplined because I had a certain sensitivity being a white Southerner. Now, I could not understand why other people couldn't get that kind of sensitivity maybe right away, but it was a cultural difference. Because there was an arrogance on the part of some volunteers, not just white volunteers who came from the North. Some of the most arrogant people from the North were black. And very articulate, made me feel bad, not even knowing the words. You know, I didn't know the words. But I learned. I learned from them right away. In fact, the most amazing thing I ever saw very early on was Tim Jenkins, who was one of the best debaters, very articulate, extremely smart, incisive, boom. I saw him go against, what's his name, ran a National Review?
William Buckley.
At Madison, Wisconsin. NSA, a convention, in probably 59 or 60. And I had never seen a black man talk to a white man like that. Tim Jenkins cussed that man for 5 minutes without using a recognizable cuss word or repeating himself. I had never, ever, as a white Southerner, seen a black person talk to a white person like that. And it did my soul good. Because I had already peeped his whole card, this man, of National Review. And I had never seen, he called him, he said, because Bill Buckley had said something about SNCC. He said, "The young Americans for Freedom, yeah, will bury SNCC." And Tim Jenkins kind of leaned back and he said, "That's the kind of slave-owning mentality of an arch-Nazi, crypto-Nazi, kind of slave-owning mentality of white people that we've always had. You think that just because Yap is white that it's going to beat SNCC? There ain't no way that's going to happen." And I had never, I mean, I just, he did it a lot better than that, I can guarantee. But anyway, my reaction to the volunteers as they came down was that, yes, this is going to be a problem. But also, I thought, and I think I was mistaken in this, I thought that people's position in SNCC, in terms of the leadership, I thought it depended more on their understanding. In other words, white people would have an understanding that the leadership in SNCC was properly black. It was properly young black Americans, men and women, and they are the leaders of this movement. I never had any doubt that they were my leaders. I had Jim Foreman, for instance. Jim Foreman made no doubt about it when we first met that he was my leader. He said, "Take this broom and sweep up." And I had just graduated with highest honor from London College in Montgomery, Alabama. And I was sweeping the broom, Foreman watching, and I was thinking, what would my classmates think? I graduated ahead of my class, and now a black man hands me a broom and says, "Sweep the floor." And he said, "There's no shit work in SNCC, and all do it." And Foreman not only handed you the broom, he used the broom. I don't know if he uses it at home, Mildred, or not. But he did with us. Anyway.
No.
Don't get me started. But I always thought that any influence that a person would have in SNCC depended, number one, on their good sense. Mm-hmm. And if people were arrogant and didn't have good sense, they wouldn't have any influence in SNCC. Right. So I wonder, who are the white people that you was worried about taking over SNCC. Who are the white liberals that is going to control SNCC? The Atlanta Project. And I want you to tell me who these people are who are bound to take over. They're white and they're going to take over SNCC. I just don't think it was ever a problem. I don't think it was a possibility. Because anybody white in the organization who did not understand that the leadership was black was not going to have any influence anyway, could not take over nothing, and would not take over anything. So I think that what was happening was that SNCC missed the boat a little bit because the Panthers did solve the problem of black and white. They said, we will work with anyone who is a revolutionary, with anyone who is going in the direction that we're going in. Now, they did not have the history that SNCC had with these volunteers, with the appearance that when people came in, and I can type better, so Susie, you move out of the way. Miss Susie, you move out of the way. I'm going to do the typing. I'm going to do the mimeographing and so forth. These were people who did not have the sensitivity of a goat. These are people who should not have any influence or any power in an organization, and I don't think they would ever have that power. So these were some of the things that I asked. At the time, unclearly, I didn't have a clear understanding of what was happening at the time. But I do realize, as a sociologist now, and as a historian, I realized that it was in the context of a whole lot of other things. For instance, what was our position on the war? What was the position of SNCC on the war? We dragged Martin Luther King, kicking and screaming, to his opposition to the war. We dragged Martin Luther King, kicking and screaming, in a lot of cases, against an economic analysis that would take him to take up poor people's campaign. So when we took a position against the Vietnam War, we exposed ourselves. When we further took a position on Palestinian self-determination, which we had to do in terms of our own politics and our own understanding of the worldwide struggle, we had to do that. That caused us tremendous problems because of the black-Jewish coalition that we'd always had. Is that going to ruin our fundraising base and so forth? The third one then, when SNCC became all black, was another of those things. And when SNCC gave up the nonviolent position, that was really a lot of what the people were looking, and you can speak to this from being in the friends of SNCC and so forth. Did that not give people who were already a little shaky, did not that final give them the excuse now, okay, we're getting out, we're going, we're booking. So those are questions that I ask. I am so happy that we're doing this because we're doing it on a collegial basis, which we have not been able to do before. And this kind of thing allows us also to tell our stories, and we are learning more about each other than we never knew. Gwendolyn worked in Laurel for a year and a half. I started working there in the GROW project, and we worked there for almost a decade in the same place with the same people, and we had not realized that we both worked in. So we're learning so much about each other, and we're learning to really look at these questions in a mature way, in an academic way in a little bit, but also from the heart, because that's what we did, everything from the heart.
Trying to manage time a bit, but I want everybody to be able to speak to this. At some point this time later, I'm going to go back to Bob and ask him, the Black Power Movement asked whites of conscience to go into white communities and organize white people at the root of racism. Both he and Susan did that, right? So I want to come back to that, but right now I want to turn to Howie and have any reaction he wants to his perspective.
Well, I sort of don't want to get it in the way of this. I like the way Fanny drew out the implications of my paper and nailed the point I didn't quite make, which was the problem was whites tripping on stuff and trying to make it their own when it couldn't be their own. But beyond that, I kind of like what's happening, so yeah. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Sue?
I think just two quick things. At an earlier time, as I said earlier, SOC was organized in the spring of 1964. And I think for those of us who were involved in that early organization in Nashville, we were pretty clear that whatever we were doing was to be a part of SNCC and to be supportive of SNCC. But other people, and a month we organized in Nashville in April of 64, we went to the SNCC Executive Committee meeting in May of 64 to ask for their support and to ask for $300. We had been given $300 by SCEP, and we needed another $300 just to get off the ground. And the conversation inside that executive committee was really educational for me, because there was a long conversation about whether to support this white organization. And many people inside SNCC felt that this would be a competitive organization, that it could drain energy and money away from SNCC. Now I was so, I think, naive at the time. I could not imagine. I mean, SNCC was, a very powerful organization at this point. It had, both the SNCC chapters were already organized, and people were getting ready to come south that summer. So I couldn't wrap my mind around this little fledgling organization trying to work with students on white campuses being competitive. And I didn't understand until much, much later that criticism. I was really blinded about that criticism, about that we should be competitive. And I just didn't get it. But the people who supported us that day in that meeting, the primary person who supported us in that meeting was Dr. Carmichael. And so the people who supported us in that conversation were the people who really then began later in the organization to lay out the position of Black Power. And so I think they could see that this was where we should be headed in terms of why it's working in white communities. So I thought that was important. The other thing is just a personal thing, because you asked us to talk to how this impacted us. And it goes back, for me, to that issue of leadership. I Stokely Carmichael was a remarkable leader, and I trusted him. I trusted, I had this incredible leadership that I talked about, both in Nashville and in SNCC otherwise. You had to think that this was the right thing to do and the right way to go. So it felt right to me. Although I think when I looked at what had happened 2 to 3 years down the road, in terms of white activists, the separation from this mass movement and from Black leadership did not do well for white activists, I think, because there was no reality check around the activism in some way. So I think it had a negative impact on the white activist movement, because it was separated from this real mass community-based movement, and that was not that helpful.
Can we thank all the panelists for our work? And let's try to get as many questions as we can. Questions, comments. Sorry.
A quick question for Mr. Zellner. Was there ever a point during the separation and the resignation of the white workers in SNCC? Was there ever a sense that yes, this is time? Or, and I guess I'm asking you to generalize, so maybe I should just ask you, I sort of missed your own personal response. I got a little of what you were thinking intellectually, but, at any point, did you say, yes, this is time, or this is the way it has to be, or?
No.
I don't mean to be intrusive, I mean it to be instructional also for, relationship?
Yes. In fact, in some ways I thought it was past time and that I had to do a personal criticism of myself because I had been so wrapped up in and so enfolded in the black community for so long that the black community was comfortable and safe, and to go to my cousins and my aunts and my uncles and so forth in the Klan, who have already said they want to kill me, you know, it was a cold world out there. But as Sue pointed out, maybe the White Folks Project was not ready in 64, but certainly by 66 and 67, it was ready and it was time. And I approached the separation with SNCC, I think philosophically. Number one, it did hurt really badly because it was like being cast out. It was like graduating, you know. Now it's time, you gotta go. You gotta go in the cold for the world. So, but I knew that this was what we should do. And I also knew I could be conceited a little bit. And I said, if anybody's able to do it, I should be able to do it with my background. And that's why we had prepared the project GROW, grassroots organizing work, which is what Professor Charles was mentioning. Now, that we had the GROW project and we were presenting it as a SNCC project. We wanted to do it as SNCC because we had one almost irrefutable proposition, and that was that maybe is arguable, and it's probably true, that you can organize black people as black people. Nobody would say that you could organize white people as white people without it being a racist formation. It would be a racist thing. And if we're going to organize in the Deep South with poor and working class white Southerners, because we weren't about going about the tea set and working with the middle class, the liberals, the moderates, or whatever, we're going to the working class. We had no illusions about what that had to be, and it had to be interracial, had to be. Otherwise, how could you organize black and white workers to get together? So we were doing something that was a little bit counter. We're going now to the white community to organize, but we ain't gonna be able to organize them as white people. And when we had our first rally near East Ogeechee, Mississippi, which is now coming into the history books, I just read a tremendous historical monograph on the new communist movement, which is also part of the bad 60s. The black power and nationalism, part of the bad 60s. Civil rights movement and love and brotherhood, the good 60s. Well, they start out with a rally that we had in East Ogeechee, Mississippi, with the October League, so forth, and when was it? Do you remember, Fonsky?
75?
I don't remember that one. But anyway, okay. But that was thousands of, well, it was 50 organizations or so, and lots of people all over. And we had had rallies in Mississippi, in Jones County, Mississippi, which you know. Because, well, we couldn't have it in Jones County because the sheriff didn't support us, but in the next county over, we could have our rallies. We had rallies in Calpashes where we had 2,000 workers, 1,000 black workers, 1,000 white workers. The white workers had wallet stickers on the back of their car and a whip antenna that said, "We are Klan." And the black cars had MFDP on the back, on the bumper sticker. We had the people coming together. We had the whole state of Mississippi concerned because it looked like the KKK and the communists were getting together and forming an alliance. What do you do about that? I mean, the Mississippi papers went crazy. They'd have a stack of pulpwood. We were working with pulpwood workers, catfish workers, chicken workers, and so forth. They have a big pile of pulpwood, and at the bottom of the pulpwood, they'd have what? A hammer and sickle, you know? Klan and the communists are getting together. Wow, how does that work? Well, that was what we were able to do. But we couldn't do it as organizing white people. But that's what we had to do. That's what we did in the GROW Project, grassroots organizing work, which we also called Get Rid of Wallace. Now, one of the reasons that my conscience is clear, that I worked as long as I could work in SNCC, from 1961 to 1967, I think, And then we formed the Grow Project and worked for about 10, 12 years in the Deep South and proved that you could get workers together on the basis of that. Now, a whole bunch of things began to happen after that. A lot of sectarianism, a lot of dogmatism and so forth in the movement. And we not only splintered, we fractured, we had mitosis. Everybody had their own little thing, you know. And we still suffer from that to a certain extent, from identity politics. And the question is, what do we take this history and where do we go from here? Tomorrow, the world.
Anybody got a question after that? Tomorrow, we'll be taking care of
them. Thank you.
My question is for Dr. Simmons. I was here for your presentation this morning, and I'm really interested in your own kind of personal experience. I'm interested in the speed of your transformation between Freedom Summer and 64, when you kind of, you didn't celebrate the presence of white nationalists, you kind of appreciated that white bodies kind of serving as barriers to black deaths, a minimum, right? Mm-hmm. Then you fast forward 2 years, 66, and a white presence in this and SNCC considered an obsolete. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you might be able to give us a little bit more on to what you attribute the speed of this transformation. Was it the tensions with white activists in southern Mississippi? Was it the move from, you know, a rural kind of movement in Mississippi to an urban movement in Atlanta? Was it something I'm not thinking of?
Yeah. Certainly an excellent question, and I think that there were a number of factors. The situation in Mississippi around the violence, the killings, the burnings, the crosses, the threats. That really wore me down. I mean, I began thinking, you know, is it ever going to end? Is nonviolence, you know, really the way to go? Don't we have to fight back? You know, so that was a piece. There was a big demonstration where we had about 1,000 people in Jackson, Mississippi. Oh, more than 1,000, but 1,000 of us were arrested. And we were taken to the fairgrounds and divided into two, you know, the males and the females. And after we got there, they brought in, you know, just white men and gave them sticks. And, you know, they beat the hell out of us under, you know, the eye of the sheriff and the law. I was locked up for 15 days, and you know, a lot of people joined us because we were marching through the community, and people just jumped off the porches, you know, with their house shoes on and a baby on the hip. All these people got arrested, you know, babies, little kids. It was horrible. I mean, what happened, you know, and it took them a long time to get us out of there, you know. So that had a terrible impact on me. And thanks to Jim Foreman, after I had come out of that situation, the situation in Laurel had gone downhill. And Jim said, you got to come out of the state. Because you're going to have a breakdown. You know, a number of people, SNCC folk, and now we know what it was, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, we didn't know what in the hell to call it then, you know. But, you know, a number of us had breakdowns, you know, and so I was definitely on the verge of that, and Jim Foreman definitely saved my life, my sanity at least. So I went to New York to work in the Friends of SNCC office. And that was a real shock. First of all, it was all white. And I felt that I was really treated badly by the staff. That was one. And it was sort of like, I was like, is this the Friends to my organization?
Right.
You know, who the hell do you all think you are? You know, so that then, because I had raised quite a bit of money in Laurel and raised stuff, Jim was thinking of grooming me to be a fundraiser, which is quite ironic given that I spent a big part of my life being a fundraiser for the American Friends Service Committee. But I went with him to, you know, on fundraising, and all the people that the money was raised from, except for Harry Belafonte and what's that other,
Sidney
Poitier, they were all whites. And I really found it difficult what was going on, where people were basically telling Jim what they wanted SNCC to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I thought we were directing SNCC. That SNCC was our organization. These people up here in New York with the money are saying what we should be doing. That was another piece. I had never lived in the North, and, you know, as it turned out, I get there when Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka, has started the Black Arts Theater. I start hanging out there. There's all this black cultural stuff going on, so this also has an impact on me. Then Julian gets kicked out. I tell the national office I want to go back to Atlanta. I really want to be involved in working there. And so I know what you might be thinking, Bob, but really in that national office, there were people who were white who clearly felt that they were the movers and shakers there,
mm-hmm.
and that they could tell us what to do. And I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. And so I hook up with the Atlanta Project people who are also chafing.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of brings us together. And it's like, well, wait a minute now. Is this the black movement anymore? Whose movement is this? Are we being used to carry out other people's movement? So it really wasn't about the volunteers. I mean, yes, we had love fest, we cursed each other out, you know, we did the whole thing, but it wasn't that. It was a more beginning to believe that this was no longer a black-led movement. That it may have the facade of that, but that underneath and behind and all, there were other forces directing it. And it just so happened that the people who came together, Michael Simmons, Dwight Williams, Bill Ware, myself, and others, all had that same feeling, even though we had worked in different places in SNCC. And so, and then the, you know, the arguments around the nitty gritty, and, you know, they didn't even want us to call it the nitty gritty. I mean, it was just little things that started getting big because they thought that shouldn't be the name of the paper. And we were saying, but the people can really relate to this. And, you know, the national office had become a group of people who were no longer organizers. They hung with one another. It was like a closed society. And even those of us who were in the Atlanta Project couldn't fit in to that group. So we were like, well, how can some black person walking in off the street, barely literate, how are they going to see this as their organization? How does this empower them in any way? So that's the kind of stuff that was happening. Now, again, you know, we're young, we're rash, you know, we want things happening immediately, change. So, you know, in many ways, I think that we blew some things out of proportions. And when I think a number of the whites who worked in the national office really saw us as a threat, so the hostilities grew exponentially very quickly. And so there was just bad blood that started really developing at a rapid rate. And it, so there were those kinds of factors that propelled me from you know, thinking that it's our movement, we've invited all these people to come, we need them, we obviously have to deal with the difficulties that bringing black and white young people together to be organizers on the ground, in the community, but that was really not it. It was these other forces.
But the rapidity with which black actors
changed. No, I think that the reason this is so interesting to me is because I'm living outside the country by this time, you know, and so I'm just excited to hear this history. The two things, though, that both of you are saying. There's very different perceptions of white involvement.
Yeah.
And just as I think the black liberation struggle is extremely important, an important phase in African American history, I also think that what he's saying about organizing white people, organizing white workers, is an extremely, extremely important part of the history. And perhaps had black power not come along and said, get up and go, maybe that work would not have gotten done. And so again, I see the importance of, you know, of this moment in history. And the other thing that's very interesting is, and in some ways it's like the discussion about whether or not to invite Obama. Right, to the anniversary. Black people in SNCC, whether they were rural people, Willie Peacock, Willie Blue, or whether or not they were blacks coming from the north, they were extraordinarily powerful people. I don't even know if some of them realized the kind of power that they had. It was awe-inspiring. I mean, for me, as a young person, it was sort of like, you know, those clown cars. You know, the next person that came out was more striking than the person I just met. I mean, I thought I was in Candy Wonderland because all of these people, the strength, the power, they made, and some of the rural people in the South may not have articulated things in the same way that some of the northern students that went down did, but they were extremely articulate. And I think Stokely's famous I Drinks Wine talk is a mirror of that. And, you know, essentially what he was saying is, you know, that people may not be saying, I shall go to the chalet and take off a bottle of Pinot Noir, but they were talking about, I drinks wine, and it was a way, a very powerful way of communicating what it was that they were about. And so I didn't have the sense that, I didn't have the sense that just because people were in the South, that they weren't powerful, that they weren't articulate, that they, but again, that has to do with, you know, the kind of upbringing I had, which really valued the Southern experience. I mean, you know, my mother used to say, you must save the historically black colleges and universities. They are the ones who educated us when white institutions would not take us. And we may get to a day, and we have come to it, where they will not take us in. And if you don't have those institutions, you know, you're going to need them.
Is there any final question for the one here? Angela?
I actually don't know if this is appropriate, and I'm going to shut me down. And I might have missed it because I didn't attend. I wasn't able to attend every single one of them. Sessions, but I was wondering if you guys could briefly talk about what you think Barack Obama's election means.
Great question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right.
saying to, I think I might have been saying to someone in our group that, I think maybe Sue and I were talking, and I was saying, well, clearly those of us in the Atlanta Project would never have believed that in our lifetime an African American would be elected to become the President of the United States. I mean, I don't think I believed it, you know, was even possible until the Iowa vote. And when I said, oh my God, Iowa.
Those
white people voted for him. I was like, okay, maybe this is a different moment in this country's history, you know. Let me see what's going on here, you know. So, at the same time, you know, and certainly I voted for Barack. I, you know, sent my first check ever to a presidential candidate, you know, and handed out flyers, you know, worked the polls and stuff. But at the same time, I continue to be skeptical. I mean, not only that, I mean, I started believing he could win. But then the question was, what does it mean if he wins? First of all, you know, I have a certain sense that nobody is going to be permitted to win unless certain forces in this country say it's okay. And, you know, I don't believe it's just vote and get them in, right? You know. And so it's like, okay, who wants him and why? And is it in my interest? I'm not sure, because I don't know who these folks are, you know. And so it's, you know, in my own opinion, you know, as a person, I think symbolically it's incredible. I think as incredible as having Barack is having Michelle as the first lady.
Yes.
Ladies? Black women as ladies?
First.
We have never been ladies. I mean, wow. As the first lady of America? I mean, and of course, as a person who's, you know, lived abroad, I know what this means for the whole world.
Yeah.
Because, you know, anti-African and anti-people of African descent is a worldwide phenomenon. And so to have her strutting around in England and France and, you know, if they go to the Arab world, and I mean, hey, you know, with black women who look like her. So it's like, hey, Barack, if you didn't do anything else, you brought Michelle to the White House.
Brought Obama too.
And brought the black family to the White House.
Yes, yeah, the little girls big, and all, yeah.
A
so.
Big, big difference.
It is. Oh, Bob, since you are pro inviting him,
I'm very pro inviting the president to come to the 50th anniversary of SNCC, and it has become a controversy. Now I'm on the planning committee, and I didn't know it was going.
And who appointed you?
You. Well, that's what everybody needs to insist. Who are the members of the planning committee? How did they get to be members of the planning committee? And so forth. Now, I was criticized severely because I went against a decision of the planning committee. The planning committee decided not to invite Obama and Mrs. Obama. Not to. I missed the meeting. I thought the whole question would be, I really did, I was naive. I thought the whole question would be, who is best to invite the president? John Lewis could do it. Julian could do it. Julian was known as the first Obama.
Yeah.
Or maybe Obama was known as the second Julian.
There you go.
I don't know. But I thought that would be what it was. But no, they decided unanimously not to invite the president. So when I took it up with members of the committee, they said the decision is made, it's irrevocable, you can't change the committee, you can't change the decision. Don't say that to a SNCC person, whether they black or otherwise. You mean a little committee has gotten together and decided they're not going to do that? So I brought it to the SNCC list, which is the only existence that I know that SNCC has outside of the now planning committee. But everybody said, uh-oh, I let the cat out of the bag. And then everybody said, well, who's on the committee? How did the committee get? So it brought a whole controversy. But I did think that because of what we did, I signed one of my books. I forgot, can I hold up this book? I hope everybody knows about the book. This is a little commercial, but this is my book called The Wrong Side of Murder Creek. And it's my memoir of working in SNCC. And when I signed a copy of it for the president, I said, Dear President Obama, I joined your campaign 48 years ago.
Wow. Nice. You gave him a copy.
I did. Now, what I thought was...
You have to read everything, don't you?
What I thought was...
Hopefully he won't read it.
I thought that one of the problems we had in SNCC was that the adult historians and the anti-left historians in this country, they pay attention to Martin Luther King, St. Martin, and that's SCLC, and NAACP, been here forever, always be, and good, thank goodness I'm a member of the NAACP now, or as my friends say, NCAAP or whatever, but... they get it mixed up with the basketball group. Anyway, I said that they talk about SCLC, CORE, NAACP, and historians don't talk about SNCC because number one, it's students. We were wild. We were unruly. Nobody had any control over us except ourselves, and we had very little self-control. So I said, how do we get into the history books? Well, one is that you have the first black president to come and speak to your organization. And people would say, well, what is SNCC? Why is he going there? What's significant about SNCC? But everybody said, no, don't invite him because it'll keep us from doing what we want to do. Well, first of all, we don't know yet what we want to do. So how can you keep you from doing that if you didn't know what you wanted to do to begin with? So I said, we should invite, and it would help us at least get on the map. And SNCC people are not shrinking violets so that the White House press corps is going to roll all over everybody. We get our message out in spite of them trying to keep our message down. It gives us a way to get the message out. But anyway, it is a controversy, and we're working it out.
Well, for me, yes, of course, it's a fantastically symbolic moment. It represents, a long history of struggle, beginning with John and Paul Covey, when the civil rights movement began back in the 18th century. What we talked about this morning is the sense of powerlessness in the schools. This feeling that young people have that they can't make change. But with the Obama election, people felt that they made change. It was the beginning of a re-empowering movement. And so for me, this moment of re-empowerment is so important. That what I want to do is to seize the moment, to give people a sense, yes, you accomplished this, but now you can make him accountable to you. But the only reason that you can do that is if you are organized yourself and you are clear what you want, that you have put him in the White House. You have the power to do that. Now, make him have the power to do what you want. So that's what the election represents for me.
I had the pleasure for 5 years of studying Zen martial arts, and it seems to me Zen. I wish as a political activist I was better at Zen, because I think the thing about this election is to really appreciate how amazing it is. And I heard Gregory in D.C. said a month ago, was it the Klan guy? He had an argument with to tell him he'd been right, that in fact it would be a black president, you know, that they've been right all along. And at the same time, to see the limitations of the current state of democracy in America and accountability, and to be able to hold both of those in your head at once. I think to me what's significant, I live in Durham, North Carolina. The Durham for Obama list, which still exists as an organization working on education, health care, voting rights, and so on, of people who worked on the campaign, and how big is, people have any idea how big Durham is? Maybe 170,000. The list of people who work actively on the campaign, an email list, is 13,000 people.
Wow.
Durham came out of Obama came out of Durham in a state that had gone almost 60-40 for Bush in 2004. Came out with an 80,000 plus per hour, a very highly organized campaign. The mission statement for Durham Obama today says that Durham for Obama exists in dynamic interplay with the national organization, leaving it the space to disagree when it sees fit to. And so, you know, we won North Carolina. You have to be from North Carolina
to understand that.
How amazing that is. But there's lots of work to do. And it does the hope that it can bring about change. That's what the movement that brought about Obama, that's what we have to figure out ways of recreating and keep building. So that's it.
I agree with the Michelle Obama position. This is the first time I was really proud to be a part of the democratic process in this country. I feel like I have voted for a democratic candidate for president ever since I became a voting age, and I've hated every minute that I had to make that choice and make it. I was never happy that those are the choices I've had, and I never thought any real change would occur. And this time I relished being part of the democratic process and being engaged in the campaign. I could get 2 cent money for the first time and really wanted this change to happen. The other part of it for me, however, was where we are politically in this country in the larger political context. I felt that if John McCain was elected president, I think for the first time I felt like I can't anymore struggle to change this country if this country elects John McCain. I'm ready to give up and move to another place or drop out of political activism altogether because enough is enough. And so I felt like we had to have this kind of change. And my friend Bill Strickland at UMass, which a lot of people know here, gets just mad as hell because he thinks that people think that Obama is a messiah. And he wants all of us to know that that's not, and we do have to keep struggling, and we cannot give up on pushing back. And I think he's right about that. But, you know, good for us, by the way.
So we are up against the clock. I'm going to take the chair's prerogative and ask one question and ask you to make fairly brief responses before you leave. I'll take one of the prerogatives. You know, all of my race classes here. These papers will not be due Monday morning. For me to say this, the crude way to say it is, how can a white person be good? Right? A question has come up in almost that form, 2 different years, right? And you can sort of play with that, right? But you know what I'm asking, right? And we've heard a lot how white people are bad, about arrogance, about embedded privilege, cultural insensitivity. Before we go, I'm white's a metaphor. I could say this about northern blacks. I mean, it's the boundary crossers, right? How do some people cross these boundaries so much more successfully than other folks, right?
So whether you want to answer it in a black context or use some other kind of context, right? Or you want to talk about the people you know. Some people, Bob, cite you, right? It's the person who does that, right? With a certain kind of skill, that's right. But anyway, however you want to come at that, right? All right? What are the lessons to be learned from your experience?
Well, it's interesting because we were at the Urban Craft Academy this morning, and I was saying to the students there that one of the students asked a question of what was the hardest thing for us? Was that the question? What was the hardest thing we had to deal with? And I said two things. One was being timid and not being afraid to get more and more involved in things and wanting to sort of be safe at times that I really should have been leading with my passion about what I thought was right. And the second thing was dealing with being a white southerner and that identity of being a white southerner at a time when that represented everything that was wrong and bad and violent and vicious. And so that it was a real journey for me not to hate who I was, in effect, and so that identity was very difficult. But to answer your question, I think I want to move away from the identity to go to what I learned from Miles Horton at the Highlander Center, which was a gathering place for the freedom movement, and it's been an education center for anybody interested in social change for the last 75 years. And what I learned at Highlander was to listen and to always let the answers come from the bottom and to let the people that you're working with give you the answers. And your role as an educator or as an outsider coming in to organize is to listen and to help the group that you're working with put all of their answers together so that there's a way forward. And then the way forward is some kind of action. So that's what it means to me to be a good white person, which is to listen and to let the people. It's like the SNCC said, let the people decide. Mm-hmm. Highlander does the same thing in a different kind of way.
Mm-hmm. And all I will say, because again, it goes back to the conversations we had in class, right, is that one of the problems with elite education is that it teaches you to not listen. Right? It's mm-hmm. something that teaches you to not listen to the people that you have to know, right? So that this whole unlearning process that has to go on. So.
I think the start is you can't be good by trying to prove you're good. I think that's kind of the main thing I was trying to get across yesterday. You know, there's a story about William Lloyd Garrison, whose slogan was, "No unity with slaveholders." So when the South seceded, he wasn't sure where he stood because there was no unity with slaveholders. The South had seceded. And it took some talking to him to realize that, you know, maybe something was more important than his personal moral relationship with slavery. And maybe that, you know, the fact that there were still 3 million slaves, you know, should affect his judgment in this. And the sense of proving your goodness, I think, is a dead end. And the alternative to that, I don't know how to articulate much better than what I said yesterday, which is to put yourself in a real situation with real people and figure out ways to be accountable for them. I guess it's sort of similar to what Sue's saying. Having the guts to be open to being wrong and to listening, but also figuring out how to disagree, to have a disagreement with someone that you know how to work through respectfully, to have experiences of that, and to build on those experiences. Because when I look back at my relationships, it's not really with people, this is both with white people, black people, and Latino people, it's not the people I agreed with historically the most, it's the people that I went through something with, that we worked through something with, that the relationships endure. So there's no exact recipe for that, but that's what I can garner from my own experience.
For me, it's all about process and surrendering to a process that you're not good or bad. You have to see, you know, the life in its entirety. I certainly want to think that at this phase in my life, because I mean, we can talk about this not just in terms of black white issues, and then sometimes it gets lost that black people can be as much of a stranger in the community as a white person. And, you know, we need not think that just because you have black skin that you can waltz in and you are automatically a good person, a good organizer. But what you have to do is to surrender to that learning process. You have to learn where you are, and when you kind of go through that fire, I said the other night that when I meet white people who seem to have a sense of what's going on, they are usually people who have been through this big process. They have been or in some kind of transformative relationship that moves them from where they were to where they are now. But you can't kind of see people as a concretized moment of their lives, but how they go through a particular process and what that process then makes them. And if you don't go through the process, you'll never be any different.
What was the question?
How can you be a good white person?
Oh, how can you be a good white person?
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I was puzzled about very early on in my SNCC experience was how could these young black people accept me as well as they do? Because if I thought that if the situation was turned around, that I would not have anything to do with any white person ever. I would want to kill all of them. And I wondered, how can this largeness of spirit occur? And some old people explained to me, they said, warriors against slavery, warriors against sharecropping and segregation learned very early they could not make enemies of their opponents. They could not hate their enemies because it would destroy themselves. You could not have health, mental health, spiritual health, physical health, and we already got high blood pressure and assault and all these other things. How can you carry hate about you and live a decent life? I thought that was a soul spirit. That was a soul force that I wanted to get close to. Now, I had some very early experiences that were strange to me also. I remember that I was sent to Talladega, Alabama, to Talladega College, because they wanted somebody from SNCC. And they kept saying, we want to have some workshops. We got to go down and integrate these little lunch counters in this little tiny town. And Foreman said, Bob, go over there.
Take your broom.
And start, take your broom with you. Go over to Talladega and start some workshops. I said, Jim, don't you think you should send somebody black? And he said, you'll have to do until somebody gets there. See, that same story. I went over there. I was introduced to speak to the whole student body at Talladega, which was almost completely black. Afterwards, a young lady came up to me, and she said, Bob, when the president of the student body introduced you, I thought you was white. And I said, what made you think I was white? He said, well, I don't know, you look white. And she said, I think you're the whitest Negro I have ever seen. So I said, well, how do you know that I'm a Negro? She said, you have dimples. White people do not have dimples. I said, well, good.
Good.
I said, would it make any difference? She said, I don't know. I've never met any white people, but you're the whitest Negro I've ever seen. So later on,
A couple of days later, she came up to me and she said, "Bob, you're white." She told me you was white. I said, "Well, does it make any difference?" She said, "I don't know." She said, "Can I feel your hair?" This is a young woman now at Talladega College. Her father is a high school principal. She's in the black bourgeoisie. She had never met a white person. I had very little experience with black people. So she said, "Can I feel your hair?" I said, "Certainly." She felt it. She said, "Does it smell like goat skin?" And I said, "No." She said, "Well, it gets wet. Does it smell like chicken feathers?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, can I smell your hair?" I said, "Yeah." "You smell my hair?" She said, "It doesn't smell like chicken feathers." I said, "Well, is that what white people's hair smell like?" She said, "Yeah, that's what I've always been told." So we had this tremendous discussion. First of all, she thought that I was the whitest Negro that she had ever seen. Then she found out I was white, and I kept saying, "Well, does it make any difference?" At that time, we didn't know whether it made any difference or not. But I knew that I was into a great, great adventure, and it still continues. Thank you.
Wow, that's a pretty tough question, Charles, because I guess I'm of the view that what makes at this stage in my life, what makes a good white person is the same thing that makes a good black person, a good Latino person, a good Asian person. And that's about some of the things that people have talked about here in the sense of openness, ability to have a certain humility about oneself, about what one knows and does not know, and the ability to learn and constantly open to that learning. I think, you know, what we have to be about now, I think we're at a different time. And it's a different set of things that are required of us as organizers. And I think that we have to certainly rid ourselves of racism. So certainly people who are white, people who... and we have to rid ourselves of the internalized self-hatred and all of that. And I think... to some extent, that really has happened in a way that, you know, is very different from the way it was in the period that we were talking about today. So I think it's really about openness. It's about humility. I think it's we all people, and I've certainly learned this through the years of teaching, is that we need serious education. For change, and if that means setting up freedom schools, setting up ways of educating young people and ourselves continuously about the nature of the needed progressive change in our country and in our world, that's what we should be engaged in.
Those were really eloquent answers to an almost impossible kind of question. But that's a really inappropriate way to end what for me, and I know for my students, has been really two good days of just challenging, supportive kinds of discussion. So thank all of you.